Available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Nigel Hewin, to this week's edition of Outlook, being recorded on Wednesday, the 10th of September, 2025. And coming up in this week's programme, Elaine will be visiting Morton Morrill. We'll complete the story of Percy Fawcett, who went missing in the Amazon jungle looking for a lost city. Margaret brings us more tales from Dictionary Corner. And Police Dog, the canine crime busters. Dave and Graham complete their visit to Bristol by going to see John Cabot's boat, which took him to Newfoundland. And we'll complete this week's story, this week's programme, with the ending of the poem On the Marshes, written read by Margaret. But of course, there's also your sport, postbag, and news from the hub. But as ever, we're going to start with a summary of the local news with Elaine and Jeremy.
Outlook News.
A Quaker meeting house in Coventry is set to receive a £25,000 grant that will fund a revamp to make it more accessible. The building, which dates back to 1953, hosts many support and community organisations, including parent and toddler groups, counselling services, religious groups, and support for refugees and asylum seekers. The grant is part of a £1 million payout by the National Churches Trust to help to keep churches, meeting houses and chapels open and in use. Changes to the building will enable more members of the community to use it and allow it to host events to combat loneliness. A lift to the first floor meeting room will be added, with access to the kitchen also being opened up. Accessible toilets and baby changing areas are also among the improvements planned, along with safety improvements to the ground floor meeting room. The changes have been decided following consultation with groups who use the building, as well as those who are currently unable to use it due to lack of accessibility. Our Quaker meeting house dates back from the 1950s and is of its age. We are keen to bring it up to modern standards, and so we and the communities of Coventry can use it for generations to come, said Leslie Butterwick, the convener of the design group. We are pleased the National Churches Trust is making a good grant towards this much needed work. We will be able to open up our building to groups currently unable to access it and make it easier for all to use. The alterations and improvements we plan will make the building more user-friendly, while keeping the much-appreciated sense of it being a welcoming space for all.
A pop-up exhibition celebrating Bob Dylan ahead of his first ever concert in Coventry has been launched. The display at the multi-award-winning Coventry Music Museum in Walsgrave Road will celebrate the music superstar, as well as the popular cover of his song Maggie's Farm by The Specials, one of Coventry's most famous bands. Visitors will be welcomed to the Still Working on Maggie's Farm exhibition until December this year. During the exhibition's run, the Coventry Building Society Arena will host a sold-out Dylan concert on the 13th of November. The museum said the exhibition would centre around a Bob Dylan-themed room, which would feature items relating to some of his most famous lyrics. It's been developed to coincide with the UK leg of Dylan's Rough and Rowdy Ways tour, which will see him perform in venues across the UK during November, from Brighton, Swansea and Coventry to Leeds, Glasgow and Belfast. Mike Lloyd, industry expert and music promoter, said the concert would be a win for Coventry. It's absolutely huge, because people travel from everywhere for it. It's particularly massive because it's the only tour gig in the Midlands, and because it's Bob Dylan. He so rarely appears in this country, loads of people will be coming out to what I'm sure will be a sold-out show.
Successful tests have been carried out to see whether drones can carry defibrillators effectively to patients suffering cardiac arrest in remote locations. Researchers at the University of Warwick worked with the Welsh Ambulance Service on the trial, held at the former RAF Bentwaters Air Base in Suffolk. They wanted to explore the benefits of getting defibrillators to places not easily accessible by road. The research team, which also worked with Dorset-based drone firm Skybound, said the trials were a success, adding that they were now looking to conduct larger-scale trials. The university said there are more than 40,000 cardiac arrests outside hospitals every year in the UK, but the survival rate was less than 10%. Defibrillators can double the chance of survival, but can be difficult to find in an emergency or in remote areas. The researchers tested drones carrying them in mock emergency scenarios. They found they could be launched quickly and then piloted accurately to the target location. Dr. Christopher Smith from the University of Warwick said, "We've successfully demonstrated that drones can fly safely to long distances with a defib attached and maintain real-time communications with emergency services during the 999 call." He said he believed the system could be used for real emergencies across the UK soon. Carl Powell, clinical lead for acute care at the Welsh Ambulance Service, said the technology showed a great deal of promise. "In a cardiac arrest, every second counts," he added. Steve Holt, who survived two cardiac arrests in remote beauty spots, said he believed the drones could help to save lives. When the 74-year-old collapsed while out walking with his son Mark in the Lake District in 2019, it took an ambulance 25 minutes to reach him by road. Luckily, Mark had managed to find a defibrillator on the outside of a pub, but he said, "While I was resuscitating Dad, waiting for help, felt like an eternity."
The BBC has been finding out what drives street pastors across the Midlands to do what they do. Motivated by their Christian faith, the street pastors regularly get feedback from people in crisis that they have helped. As one street pastor commented, they say, "You helped my friend," or "You helped my brother." One volunteer described how he and a police officer once talked down from a bridge a young man who went on to get psychiatric help. 6 months later, that same young man came to one of our street pastors and said, "I want to thank you. My life is so much better now." Erica Young from Coventry Street Pastors said, "I've always felt it's really important as a Christian that you don't just go to the church on a Sunday. You get out of the church. You get to where the people are, the needs are." She said she joined the group because it was something she thought would have been great when her children were younger. She described getting a buzz from helping people. "There are some Fridays when I think, I'm so tired, I'm not in the mood. But every single time you go out, there's always somebody whose life you touch." Over more than a decade, she has helped a variety of people, including women being followed, and given advice to a member of the LGBTQ plus community who had been pushed out of their church. As one street pastor put it, "Though we do have what I call faith conversations, primarily the language that we're using is the language of love. We're caring, we're listening, and we're helping."
A father says a scheme which helps young people with learning disabilities into work has been life-changing for his son. Andy Darleston's son, Harry, is autistic and was part of the scheme, ending up with an internship at a firm which manufactures signs in Warwickshire. The supported internship programme at North Warwickshire and South Leicestershire College sees students given a 10-week work placement alongside tailored job coaching and life skills support. He's made new friends. His confidence has increased. He's completely come out of his shell. It's just been the making of him, it really has, Mr. Darlaston said. The 56-year-old said his son was now thriving because of the scheme. Without all of the support from the internship team and everyone at Nuneaton Signs, we wouldn't be where we are today, he said. Figures released in 2024 from the Department for Work and Pensions show only 4.8% of adults who are autistic or have a learning difficulty get paid employment. Paula Jeffries from the college said they were seeing a good number of students end up in paid employment. Across 4 years of the programme, nearly two-thirds of students secured a paying job. Importantly, she went on to explain, that it isn't that people with autism don't want to work. Rather, the problem is they wouldn't necessarily be able to go through a typical recruitment process.
Coventry's Hospital Trust has been rated as the third worst performing in England in new league tables published this week. The University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire UHCW Trust comes in at 132nd out of the 134 acute or emergency NHS trusts in England, according to figures from NHS England. The government rankings, published for the first time, rank the performance of NHS trusts scored on 7 different areas, including patient waiting times, cancer treatment, urgent and emergency care, and ambulance response times. Professor Andy Hardy, UHCW Chief Executive Officer, said he was disappointed with the ranking, adding that the trust was looking to see where it could make positive changes for patients. South Warwickshire University NHS Foundation Trust, which operates Warwick Hospital, was ranked as the 25th best within acute trusts, with Nuneaton's George Elliott ranked in 121st place. Coventry and Warwickshire Partnership NHS Trust, which is responsible for mental health treatment, was rated 51st in the non-acute trusts league table. Speaking about UHCW's ranking, Professor Hardy said, "We are disappointed by our position in the table. Through the efforts of our staff, we have already seen improvements in some key areas. We continue to strive to provide high levels of service for our patients, as evidenced by our recent Care Quality Commission inspection. This rated both our hospitals, University Hospital Coventry and the Hospital of St Cross Rugby, as good for patient care and safety."
The new Bishop of Coventry has taken her seat on the famous red benches of the House of Lords after a ceremony which saw her swear the oath of allegiance to the King. Coventry's first female bishop, the Right Reverend Sophie Jelly, started work in the city in June after she was installed in February. She has joined the Lords Spiritual, who have 26 places reserved in the unelected Upper House of Parliament for senior Church of England bishops, including the Archbishops of Canterbury and York. The 53-year-old, who was ordained in 1997, was supported at her introduction to the Lords by the Bishop of London and the Bishop of Sheffield. Bishop Sophie served as curate in Shipley in Yorkshire before spending 3 years in Uganda with the Church Mission Society. She later went to hold a series of roles in the church, including serving as a vicar in Burgess Hill in Sussex, and more recently as the Bishop of Doncaster. A keen runner, Bishop Jelly is married with 3 children. She is a soprano singer and plays the violin and viola.
A couple set to celebrate their 73rd wedding anniversary have been described by their family as our king and queen. Bob and Pat Page, who live in Coventry, got married on the 6th of September 1952 after meeting at work. Their granddaughter, Holly Page, said she believed the pair may hold the record for being the longest-lived married couple in Coventry. "They're our king and queen. We love them to bits. They're amazing," she said. "They just love each other so much." She added, "Grandad writes Christmas cards and birthday cards, and in them he'll write, 'To the only woman I've ever loved.'" The couple, who are just 2 years away from their diamond wedding anniversary, met when working at BSA Bicycles in Birmingham. They courted for 6 months before getting engaged and married. "She stole my heart, and she still does," Mr. Page, 96, explained. Mr. Page has dementia, and he is cared for by his wife, 93, who said she was his first girlfriend. "He was very handsome," she said of her husband. "He was a cyclist. He had blonde, wavy hair. He was so good-looking." Speaking to BBC CWR, the pair advised other couples hoping for a long marriage to be tolerant and patient with each other. "Just get through things. You just stick together and work together, and that's the way you get through it," Mrs. Page said. "Don't expect too much of each other."
Some of the best cyclists in the world were making their way around Warwickshire last week as the UK's biggest road cycling event of the year visited the county. The Lloyd's Tour of Britain Men's Stage 4 set off from a packed market square in Atherstone, with riders then racing south through Ansley, Filongly, Bedworth, Dunchurch, Cuppington, Wellesbourne, Kyneton, Shipston-on-Stour and Edge Hill before a dramatic steep climb and hilltop finish in Burton-Dassett Country Park. Rolling road closures were in place as the race passed through the county's towns and villages, with hundreds of spectators lining the streets to cheer on the peloton. At Burton-Dassett, riders faced three ascents of a 700-metre climb, with the last climb finishing the race. Geraint Thomas OBE, who previously won the 2018 Tour de France, was taking part in his final professional race. Speaking to the BBC before the race set off, Thomas said, "I just do my bit for the team and try and set the boys up for those circuits, because there's a tough little loop at the end, three times up that climb." Describing the reaction of the public to seeing him in his final race, he said, "So lucky to finish it here, trying to soak it all in." Brothers Steve and Paul Kelly were there from Coventry to see the race set off. Steve said, "I love cycling. It's a great event to have locally, and really exciting to see quite a lot of top riders here today as well. We're both really into cycling. We've been over to watch the Tour de France as well in Paris a few weeks ago. So really exciting to see quite a few of the Tour riders here." His brother said, "Cycling's a really big sport, and you can see there's quite big crowds here today. So it just gives quite a bit of buzz around the region to have something like this."
A charity that supports people in clothing poverty has been forced to close to donations temporarily after flash flooding. Clothing Coventry said it would remain closed to donations all this week after water damaged a warehouse and stock last Thursday. "We will need to replace much clothing in a couple of weeks, so please hold on to donations until we can dry things out and stop the flooding," the charity said on social media. The warehouse remains open for those in need to come to collect clothes, the charity said. Chief Executive Officer Katie Wilson said they were looking for volunteers to come and take a bag of clothes home to wash and dry them. "Unfortunately, it was a section of brand new men's clothes that got the worst of it, which is always the way. It's going to be the best things that get ruined," she said. "All the new men's clothes are going to need to be washed." Ms. Wilson said the flooding came last Wednesday night when a sudden downpour resulted in water coming up through the drains and damaging stock and kitchen cupboards. About half our warehouse has been flooded, she said. It's quite bad at the moment. We're just trying to work out exactly what we can do, what's wet, what's savable, and trying to just sweep all the water out, she explained. The charity said it would post on social media when it's ready to accept donations again. We're really hoping some kind donors will come on and support us and help us get past this, because it's an unexpected cost for a small charity, Ms. Wilson added. We just don't have the funds to cover the drain doctor coming out.
Families should benefit from a £2 million revamp of a local leisure centre gym currently underway, which follows urgent repairs to the structure of the building, Nuneaton and Bedworth Borough Council says. Pingall's Leisure Centre in Nuneaton had to be shut down in January after severe corrosion was discovered on metal beams. Now, with those works completed and the beams strengthened, the council is pressing on with further aspects of the overhaul. These refurbishment works mark an exciting new chapter for Pingall's Leisure Centre, Councillor Brady Hughes said. Among the features will be an extended and enhanced gym, a new group cycling studio, and new water features. Behind-the-scenes improvements include upgraded air handling systems to enhance ventilation and energy-efficient measures to guarantee long-term environmental sustainability. Expanding the gyms and introducing state-of-the-art equipment will give its users greater opportunity to stay active and healthy, Hughes added. The new Water Confidence paddling pool and remodelled cafe at the Pingalls will be even more welcoming for families and people of all ages. The works are due to be finished in January 2026.
Outlook News.
And my thanks there to Jeremy and Elaine for the local news. Are you as confused as I am? Because I always thought the diamond wedding was 60 years, but Jeremy assures us there are two diamond wedding anniversaries, 60 and 75. So now we know. He assures us he's right. So, I've got a couple of announcements. The usual one, of course, of sunrise and sunset. Sunrise at the moment, 6:29, sunset at 7:24. And just a reminder, the last bands in the park, which runs from 2 to 3:30, of course, in the afternoon, will be this coming Sunday, the 14th of September, the Caledon Castle Park, and it will be the Covington Silver Band. So that's the last one for the season. Now, welcome, Hugh.
Thank you very much. I suppose if you've been married 65 years and then you've been married 75 years, you're probably too old to remember that it was diamond the last time anyway. So, I mean, I don't wish to cast asparagus on people, but there we are.
Yes.
I had my 15th wedding anniversary a couple of weeks ago.
There you are. What's
which
that?
Is crystal.
Crystal.
Did
you get any?
No, I got that. It was a big bouquet of flowers in a crystal vase.
Oh, nice.
That was how I managed to get that one in there.
Good.
Anyway, to our muttons. We are looking at 2026 already. Okay. Can you believe it? Specifically the ordering of diaries and calendars and what have you, the large print ones that we get from VIP diaries. So they have a range on offer, but the ones that we tend to get are the A6 little pocket diaries, which some people really like. Then there's the A5, which is like half a letter size ones, or there's the A4 size, which are the desktop ones that like two letters side by side. They're very good, very clear print, and if you use one of the big thick barrel felt pens and everything, you can and you've got a bit of sight, then you can definitely use one of these. So We're going to be ordering some anyway, but we'd quite like an idea. If anybody wants us, is definitely going to have one, then we'd like you to sort of pre-order if you can. Now, the little A6 diaries, so these are pocket ones, are going to be £7.15 each. The A5 ones are going to be £9.35 each, and the A4 ones are going to be £11.05 each. They also have A3 calendars that are big and bold and sit on your wall, and we can get some of those for £8.80 each. So if you'd like any of those, so there's the pocket diary, the A5, the A4, and then there's the A3 big calendar, then give us a call on 024-7671-7522, get through to reception, and they will make a note of your desires in this matter.
Excuse me, all those figures, they don't mean anything. I would like to order a week to view diary. Right. What does that come under?
All of them, but just in different sizes. So there we are.
That's told you.
Apart from the big A3 calendar, which okay. is apart from the big A3 calendar, which is the very big one, which sits on the wall, and then you can have a whole month.
When it's open, it'll be A4 size. So that is an.
No, A4. When it's open, when the A4 calendar is open, it's A5 size. So that
is
an A4 calendar.
Big one
and then the A5 ones, they. Yeah. They fold over, they come out, and when they're open, they're A4.
So anyway. I want an A5, thank you.
Okay, all right. Okay, well, there we are. There's one order right there. And
first order.
Yeah,
no discount there.
Yes, first order, no discount, absolutely. Yes. Do please go and tell reception, though, because I won't remember.
Well, last year's had a page missing.
Oh, dear. Was it your birthday?
It was confusing.
Yes, it would do. Yes. Yes, terrible. As I mentioned last week, the boat trip, didn't happen again. That's 2 years running. We've decided that it's right at the end of the season now. There's no likelihood of the boat trip running this year. So we're going to book it again for early next year. So at least we've got a fighting chance. So if you are one of the unfortunate second timers who really want to go on this canal boat trip and you've already paid, we will give you a refund on that. So please apply to reception for that. And then finally, we've got the open day coming up on the 9th of October. So what we're going to do on that day is open up the centre. We've got people coming in to talk, so we're going to have people from Boots with the Ray-Ban Meta glasses, which I think will be a big draw for people. We're also getting a whole bunch of equipment from Cobalt, some of which we've not seen before, like talking air fryers and various other stuff like that. We've also got Humanware coming in. Now, Humanware, they produce some very nice, has to be said, reasonably expensive video magnifiers and various other bits of kit. So they're certainly going to be there as well. We're going to have a number of representatives of our groups coming and demonstrating what they do and getting involved. We will have other people coming in doing the odd little talk here and there. So I think it's going to be a good day. So it starts at 10 o'clock, goes on till 4. So please spread it around. It's not just for our people, people who already know us. Actually, it's more for people who don't. So if you know of anybody you'd like to come along, just have a look at the place, come and find out what we're all about. Especially, given our new name, I think that would be a really good thing to do. So, we'll let you know more details as we go. And that is it for this week.
Short and sweet, as they say.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Hugh. Bye. And now Sarah's back again to bring you her sports report for this week.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to sport. Now, on this week's agenda, we have rugby union, tennis, a bit of F1, a bit of golf, and a bit of football. Okay? Right, I'd better get going then with that packed agenda. So I shall start off with the Rugby World Cup. Well, as you know, at the moment we were still in the group stages, so we got all of the home nations competing. Well, the afternoon started on Saturday with Canada taking on Scotland. And I'm afraid it was bad news for the Scottish lasses. They lost 19 points to 40. Although that's worked out in England's favour, as you'll find out in a bit. Then we had the wooden spoon match. Now, both Wales and Fiji going into this match knew that they were packing their cases and going home. But it was a case of whose case would contain the wooden spoon. Well, I'm afraid it was Wales. We got no points at all at the Rugby World Cup. We lost to Fiji 25 points to 28. So it was very tight, particularly at the end when the Welsh lasses were desperate to get a point, get some points on that board. Then we settled down for the grudge match. England versus Australia. Well, I'm afraid it didn't go to plan. It started off with Australia well in the ascendancy, and it wasn't too long before we were 0-7 down when they scored and converted. Then we scored, but we couldn't convert, so we were still 5-7 down. Then we began to regroup and it got to 10-7 to us. In fact, by half time it had got to 19-7 and I decided the sickness had gone, the sickness at the thought of losing to Australia, and I could have a little bit of tea at half time. Soon into the second half, Australia had a woman sin binned, that is, yellow carded and sent off for 10 minutes. And England really capitalised and began to load the points. Then England had a woman sin binned, but sadly I think Australia had almost given up by then. Although they couldn't totally give up, because they had to score a certain number of points to ensure their further qualification, as they were on the same number of points as the USA. Anyway, the final score was England, drum roll, 47, Australia, 7. This did mean that both teams have qualified. And England's next match is against Scotland on Sunday at 4 p.m. You see, had Scotland beaten Canada, we'd have played Canada, and Canada are the number 2 seeds in the competition. So we really didn't want that. On Sunday, Ireland took on New Zealand, who are the current world champions. And I'm afraid the gap in ability really showed. And Ireland were absolutely thumped. No points to 40. But both teams fortunately had qualified. And Ireland's next match is on Sunday at 1 p.m. against France. Now, change of ball totally. Just going to pick up on the US Open tennis. I need to start off with a huge apology to Joe Salisbury and Neil Skupski, the British men's doubles pair, the number 2 pair actually. Because last week I said that all British hopes in the US Open had ended. Well, it hadn't, because Joe and Neil made it all the way to the final. Unfortunately, losing there yet again to the Spanish-Argentinian pair, whose names I'm afraid I'm not going to attempt to pronounce. But although they have a run of losing in the final, this happened at all of the French, Barcelona and Doha, they are too good a pair. not to continue playing together. You may remember they were a bit of a scratch pairing after Joe Salisbury parted with his American partner Rajiv Ram, and they were just put together for the Davis Cup. But it's worked. In the women's final, just for information, Aryna Sabalenko beat Amanda Anisimova of the States, Sabalenko being of Belarusia. But it wasn't the double bagel, or anything like the double bagel, that Amanda experienced at Wimbledon when she lost 6-0, 6-0. No, in fact, she really pushed Sabalenko. She took her to a tie break in the final set. Now, the men's final, wow, is all I can say. It was between Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner. And those two guys are now just streets ahead of the rest of the crowd. In fact, Alcaraz had beaten Djokovic in straight sets in the semi-final. Well, I'm delighted to say that Carlos Alcaraz beat Sinner in four sets. But the match was just incredible. It was more like watching two chimpanzees, the way they were scurrying from side to side, leaping up. Even the commentators, who included a Wimbledon champion, said they just didn't know how they were getting some of the shots. Anyway, just like in France, Alcaraz won, whereas Sinner had won at Wimbledon. A quick postscript to the tennis. Carlos Alcaraz won prize money. Obviously, it's a professional game. But the prize was $5 million. That equates to £3.7 million. I was clearly in the wrong business. Now, moving on very quickly to F1. It was the Italian Grand Prix this week. And it was sort of usual names. First was Max Verstappen. Second was the Brit Lando Norris. And third was Oscar Piastri. Although it was interesting actually at the end, because Lando had, shall we call it, cock up on the wheel change front, thanks to his team. And so the team ordered Piastri to swap places with Norris and let him through again, because Norris had been safely in second prior to that. Now, there's no Grand Prix next Sunday, but the following Sunday, I believe that's the 21st, it's the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. Can't wait. Don't know what time it is, but guess it'll be the usual three. Anyway, golf. Congratulations to Rory McIlroy, who won, well, I'll say one of his home opens, when he won the Irish Open. Now, given that we now have the Ryder Cup in 3 weeks, I am getting so excited about that. It's looking good for our Rory. Just hope the rest of the Europeans are on the up as well. Just touching briefly on cricket, although I didn't mention it in my menu. Having lost the series of one-day internationals against South Africa, England faced them in the third match. So I guess South Africa probably weren't playing their strongest teams, and England were giving it a good go to not be beaten 3-0. Anyway, did they give it a good go? England were 414 for 5. South Africa 72 all out. That is blooming good. And what really impressed me was how well our batters were batting and our bowlers were bowling. So well done, England. Now, just to finish with the football, as I said last week, it was the international break for the World Cup qualifiers. Well, I'll start off with the good news. England beat Andorra 2-0. I'm sorry, rerun that. England beat Andorra by 2-0. Andorra are ranked 176th in the world. So if England couldn't score more than two goals against them, what hope is there for when we face the big teams like the Germanys and the Spains? Oh, and by the way, the first goal was actually an Andorra own goal. Oh, tootle, tootle off home. Now, I'm delighted to say that Wales beat Kazakhstan 1-0. So that was a really good win for Wales. Meanwhile, Northern Ireland beat Luxembourg 3-1. Again, an excellent result for little Northern Ireland, although they were playing little Luxembourg. But then I'm afraid Northern Ireland were thumped by Germany by the same score, 3-1. Scotland played Denmark. Denmark are one of the, shall we say, better teams by a long way in the world. And they held them to a 0-0 draw. And then last night, I'm recording this on Tuesday, they beat Belarus 2-0, and that match was in Belarus. So it's looking quite good for Scotland as well. In fact, it's looking good for all of our teams at the moment, although I still have severe doubts about England. But we're getting the points no matter how many goals we score or don't score. And finally, this just made me smile. In the Rugby World Cup match, the England versus Australia one, and it was getting towards the end, the players were locked in a scrum, and the commentator said the following: well, the scrum's not moving, but one of the women is losing her shorts. Fortunately, at that point, the scrum collapsed, and we had a bit more concentration on the rugby commentary. Anyway, lovely listeners, that has been your sport this week. Have a fantastic week ahead, and I hope to speak to you next week. Bye!
I obviously chose the wrong job. $5 million for winning. Should have practiced more. It's time for Dave with your postbag.
This is Postbag.
Hi there, and welcome to your postbag again this week. Just recently, Jag Singh told you he needed a gardener. Well, Doreen Hilton has responded straight away with a gardener that she recommends.
I understand, Jag. This is Doreen here. I understand that you want a nice gardener. Well, I have a gardener. He is his own business, very pleasant man, very nice to speak to. He comes to me every 3 weeks, right? And his name is Mark, right? I have his phone number here. If you want to get in touch with him, because he won't get in touch with you, because he's a man like that. He prefers you to get him, you know, you to get in touch with him. If this number's any good to you, by all means ring Mark, because he would be very pleased to have you. Right, here is his number, 07909713685. I'll repeat it again, 07909713685. 13685. He's very pleasant, Jack. He does have a friend who's totally blind, and he does understand your situation. I hope that will be helpful to you. Don't forget to ring him if you remember on that number, Jack. I wish you all the best, and I'm sure you will get on with him. Thank you for that one.
Thank you, Doreen. You're a great example of what Postbag is all about, helping each other. And Mark's phone number, once again, is 07909713685. I've asked you from time to time how you are enjoying the nice weather. Well, Julia has responded. Here she is for the latest report entitled A Picnic in the Park. 15 of us. It was a family picnic. My brother and sisters, their children and grandchildren, but no teddy bears. I took popcorn and sweets and 2 bottles of gin, but everybody made a contribution. We went to St. Nicholas Park near Warwick Castle, and the children played games, but they wouldn't let us join in, so we had a good old gossip, and I told them all about my friend John and all his evil deeds. The kids had mats, but the grown-ups had chairs so we could look down on them. We had lots of lovely food, batchers, chicken, crisps, and a banana cake made by Sister Donna. Of course I got drunk and got arrested, but the family surrounded the police station and I was released. We didn't save anything for my friend John and Rachel, but we pushed John into the river. Oh well, summer's nearly over. Love, Julia. Thank you, Julia. Please let us know what you've been doing during the nice weather. Summer has some lovely smells, and Edwina tells you of smells that take you back in time.
Certain smells will take you back in time, because there are many scents that were with you when you were growing up, and it suddenly comes to mind. It's good to think back to those special memories and enjoy what was the smells then. There's many different smells about now.
Thank you, Edwina. Tell us of smells that you remember. Here's a classic Postbag message from Graham Whale from the past that Graham is very fond of. Edwina asked before for you to tell us what your favourite smells were and also your favourite sounds. So here's that comment from Graham again.
I've been thinking recently about my favourite smells and how my choice of favourite smells have changed over the years for whatever reason. I mean, I grew up around the outskirts of the city, and much of the outskirts of the city was still being built in the 1950s, so the smell of a building site was never that far away. If not a building site, the smell of tarmac at them as they were constructing new roads. And I used to find that smell quite appealing until I became independently mobile. I'm afraid these days the sound, or I should say the smell, of a building site sends a completely different message to me, actually puts the fear of God up me. Also, the smell of petrol doesn't seem to be quite the same. Now, whether this is psychological, whether it's something to do with the fact that it's not good for me, or whatever, I don't know, or whether they've just put different additives to it, but I used to love the smell of petrol when I was younger, but I'm afraid these days I can't stand the smell of it. But I've always been keen on the smell of a new vehicle, a new car. I mean, when we have our homes decorated, we can't get rid of the smell of the paint quick enough. But there's something special about the smell of paint on a new car, or better still, a new car showroom. And if I was able to drive, I would have a car. I'd probably replace it every 12 months just to keep the new smell around me, if I could afford to, that is. I've always liked the smell of new mown grass, especially the first cut of the year, which seems to be quite potent. And also the smell drifting out of a pub doorway as you pass, if you're able to get past, that is. And I do mean a proper pub, not one of these silly wine bars or cafe bars which are scattered around the city. But I suppose if I'm pushed, my favourite sound would be the sound of a rough sea on a blustery day, beating up against the sea wall, with spray waves splashing over the top. As long as I'm not too close, that is.
Well, thank you, Graham, and for your messages this week. I'm recording Postbag midweek because I'm in between holiday breaks. I'm going away a couple of days' time with Graham again. So, having just come back from a Warner's holiday break at Ulverston Hall in Cheshire, where there was a Rod Stewart tribute act. So, if you've sent a message in at the end of the week, after I've recorded this postbag, I'll play it next week. Okay, well, please, let's hear from you. Have fun. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's your postbag from Dave. And this week, Elaine visits Morton Morrill, not far from Leamington Spa.
In olden times, the manor consisted of the town of Morton and the hamlet of Morrill. And 40 years ago, another residential development was added at Morton Paddocks. Entering Morton from the north, one passes a recent development of 36 houses, bordering John Taylor Way before passing Fuller Place and Oak Tree Close. A 90s and 60s sympathetic development of houses around a central green. A Mr. Fuller built the shop and post office in 1910 and was active in every aspect of village life, including long service as a district councillor, while John Taylor planted and tended roadside trees to replace the elms lost through disease around 1974. Further on to the left, a road leads out of Duffers Hill into Middletown and the cottage where William Randolph was born in 1651. Emigrating to Virginia in 1672, he was the ancestor of Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the USA. In the treed area at the corner with Brook Lane, there was once a dove house, hence the name Duffers Hill. Proceeding along the street, the 17th century Morton House was built on the site of a chantry house belonging to the Hospital of St. John at Warwick. Next to the friendly Black Horse pub is the black and white thatched 16th century well cottage, and beyond the village hall, the 19th century village school, is another similar cottage. Opposite the latter is the popular and successful Morton Morrill Church of England Primary School, built as two classrooms in 1914. Permanent extensions in the last 50 years include a hall, indoor cloakrooms, offices, kitchen and two classrooms. Having over 110 pupils, an extra classroom was due to be built early this century. Beyond the shop is the Church of the Holy Cross, adjacent to the 16th century manor house. A priest was mentioned in the Domesday Book, and the oldest part of the church is the 12th century base of the tower. Above the churchyard is the Wellingtonia lined drive, leading to the Morton Morrill Centre of Warwickshire College, originally the Farm Institute, established at Morton Hall in 1949. 100 years ago, this was largely an agricultural community served by local tradesmen such as the baker, the blacksmith, the butcher and the carpenter. Only the pub and the shop survive, while commuters doubled the population.
Next time, Elaine will bring you wartime memories from Napton on the Hill. Now, you remember last week, Bill started the fascinating story of Percy Fawcett, who went missing in the Amazon jungle 100 years ago while searching for a lost city, and he now completes that story.
The Kalapolos said that Fawcett and his party had stayed at their village, and despite warnings about fierce Indians who occupied that territory, had headed eastwards. The Kalapolos observed smoke from Fawcett's expedition's campfire each evening for 5 days before it disappeared. As a result, the Kalapolos said they were sure that the fierce Indians had killed them. Gran said Fawcett was certain that the Amazon contained a fabulous kingdom, and he was not a soldier of fortune or a crackpot. He was a man of science and had spent years trying to prove his case. Fawcett had determined that an ancient, highly cultured people still existed in the Brazilian Amazon, and that their civilization was so old and sophisticated it would forever change the Western view of the Americas. He had christened this lost world the City of Zed. Grant's book details the merciless conditions Fawcett faced, including hostile tribesmen, piranhas, electric eels, jaguars, crocodiles, vampire bats, and anacondas, one of which almost crushed him. In his report to the RGS, Grant discovered Fawcett had insisted that the snake was longer than 60 feet. Thinking he had shot it dead, Fawcett stepped forward to slice off a piece of its skin to put in a specimen jar, but as he cut into the anaconda, it jolted towards Fawcett and his party, sending them fleeing in fear. Before he became an explorer, Lieutenant Colonel Percy Harrison Fawcett, DSO, was an artillery officer. Born in Torquay on August 18, 1867, he was educated at Newton Abbott College, according to the Torbay Tourist Board, and then given a commission in the Royal Artillery at the age of 19. He became a spy for the Secret Service in North Africa and served for many years in Ceylon, later renamed Sri Lanka, where he developed an interest in archaeology, before leaving the army to take up exploration on behalf of the RGS, the Royal Geographical Society. Fawcett made 7 expeditions between 1906 and 1924, only interrupted by the First World War when he volunteered to lead an artillery brigade for which he was awarded the Distinguished Service Order. But his 7th expedition to the continent would be his last. Sometime after his disappearance, Percy's manuscripts and documents were later compiled by his younger son Brian and published in the best-selling book Exploration Fawcett in 1953. Before he left England, Fawcett had confided in his youngest son, saying, "If, with all my experience, we can't make it, there's not much hope for the others." Brian said his older brother Jack was the reflection of his father, tall, frighteningly fit, and ascetic. Brian added that Jack's 6'3" were sheer bone and muscle, and that his friend Raleigh was similarly fit. The two boys had been inseparable since their childhood, growing up in the Devon countryside. David Grand sums up the story. His feats came at a time when Britain, with the death of Queen Victoria and the rise of Germany, had grown anxious about its empire. The press seized upon Fawcett's accomplishments, portraying him like one of his childhood heroes, and holding him up as the perfect counterpoint to the national crisis of confidence. As for Fawcett, he had, according to Gran, hoped to receive the honour of immortality, and in a way, thanks to our fascination with his incredible story.
What an intriguing story that is. What's your theory? Let us know in postbag. Margaret, a regular contributor with her extracts from Susie Dent's Dictionary Corner from the Radio Times, and this week has more of the origins of interesting words and phrases for you.
Spitting image. The 19th century expression spitting image, often written as splitting image, which emerged at around the same time, is used to suggest a similarity so strong that it is as though a person has been split in two. The origin of both phrases is the older expression, spit and image, which suggests someone who is so like another that they could have been spat straight out of the latter's mouth. Say spit and fast enough, you will get spitten or later spitting. Such a doppelganger might also be known as a dead ringer, an expression that has nothing to do with the tradition of burying people with a bell in case they were still alive so that they could sound an alarm from underground. Dead here is used in the sense of exact, as in dead straight, while ringer was a term in horse racing circles for a horse fraudulently substituted for another in an important race. Speak of the devil. If someone who has just been mentioned in conversation suddenly turns up in person, we might well be tempted to say, speak of the devil, a phrase recorded since the 17th century. At that time, the full expression varied from speak of the devil and see his horns to, and he's presently at your elbow. But it settled finally on speak of the devil and he shall appear. It originally rested on the superstition that to refer to the devil directly was to risk summoning his presence, prompting the speaker to avoid it altogether. The phenomenon is often known as Noah naming, from the Polynesian Noah, meaning safe, in which an alternative word is used in place of the true name. This may include bear, which may come from an ancient term denoting any wild animal and based on a word for brown. Again, the idea was that to refer to the animal directly would cause it to appear. Wild goose chase. Nay, if our wits run the wild goose chase, I am done, for thou hast more of the wild goose in one of thy wits than I am sure I have in my whole five. In Romeo and Juliet, Mercutio speaks of losing the battle of wits against Romeo, comparing their hunt for the perfect one-liners to hunting wild goose. While Shakespeare's play gives us our first record of the expression, wild goose chase, its connections were far more concerned with horses than birds. It described an equestrian sport in which succeeding horses had to follow the course of a leader, so their formation resembled a flock of wild geese. While the geese's flight path is effective, the horse race must have seemed erratic. By the time Samuel Johnson was writing his dictionary in 1755, a wild goose chase was a pursuit of something as unlikely to be caught as the wild goose. In other words, a fruitless quest and a fool's errand.
Susie really does know a lot about English and its origins, doesn't she? Dogs generally really are amazing, but few more so than police dogs, who can be trained to search for rubble, detain criminals, and sniff out all sorts of suspect substances. Marion McCullen has written a new book about these wonderful dogs, and Elaine reads the article from the Coventry Telegraph.
Alsatian Rex III was a superstar and possibly the most renowned British police dog. He is certainly the only police dog in the UK to have a film made about him. Police Dog came out in 1955 and saw Rex playing himself. Christopher Lee also appeared in the film as a police constable, and Dad's army actor John Le Mesurier was a police inspector. James Bond creator Ian Fleming made an uncredited appearance in the movie as a man out walking his dog. Rex's handsome appearance, courage and intelligence made him famous, and he was the best thief-taker of his day. He made 120 arrests, was the first dog to help with the flying squad, and the first dog trained to detect drugs by the Metropolitan Police. Rex also proved dogs could be used to track bandits in the jungle during the Malayan War of the 1950s, and his handler, P.C. Arthur Holman, considered him the finest dog that he had encountered. Rex's fame was such that a cartoon strip about his exploits appeared in a magazine called Look and Learn in the 1950s and continued to run for 20 years. One of his early arrests involved helping to catch a gang of thieves who had carried out smash-and-grab raids at a radio and television shop in Cricklewood, a radio shop in Fulham, and a jeweller in Regent Street. The flying squad tracked them down to a block of flats and asked if they could have the help of a dog. Rex did not let them down. He chased after one of the villains as he tried to escape the police. As the man scrambled over a 6-foot gate set in a wall, Rex jumped onto the top of the wall, skidding on its icy surface and paying no heed to the 18-foot drop on the other side. The leader of the gang later said to P.C. Holman, "No copper could catch me, but if you're going to teach dogs to do that, then I'm going straight." Rex received a commendation from the judge and was rewarded for his part in the arrest with an extra portion of his favourite dinner, freshly cooked liver. Rex is among the top police dogs featured in Andy Boot's new book, Canine Crime Busters. It delves into the history and heroism of UK police dogs, exploring their evolution, highlighting amazing canines like Rex, and celebrating their bond with handlers. It also looks at how police dogs have thwarted terrorists, caught killers, and protected the public over the decades. Constable Edward Barrett used his own dog as an unofficial police dog in Launceston, Cornwall, in the 1860s, and Chief Constable Charles Warren of the Metropolitan brought in bloodhounds in the hunt for Jack the Ripper in 1889. The first official police dog was an Airedale called Topper in the 1890s, who was stationed at Hyde Park in London. But Topper was more of a publicity stunt than a working dog. The British North Eastern Railway Police introduced the first dog unit in the UK in 1908, when they deployed 4 Airedales called Mick, Jim, Vic and Ben. The skill of having the talents of a police dog to beat crime became apparent over the decades. A 4-year-old black and tan long-haired German shepherd called Major proved his worth when he tracked a robbery suspect for nearly 6 miles in Wales in the 1980s after he gave officers the slip in a disused quarry. Major then stood guard outside a building for several hours, waiting until his police handler, P.C. Alan Beddow, arrived. The police could find no one in the house when they turned up, even after a second search. But Major adamantly refused to move. So they finally let him loose in the property, and he started barking at a seemingly empty wardrobe.
The police examined it more closely and found it had a false back, and the suspect was hiding in the narrow enclosure. Major's tenacity and intelligence proved decisive in the case, and P.C. Beddow swore for years after that he could almost see Major grinning broadly after the man was discovered. His talent for sniffing out the suspect led to an arrest. Major had a good career before retiring, but was never again faced with a situation that showed his cleverness and sense of duty in such a way. Sadly, Rex never got the chance to retire. He developed throat cancer when he was just 7 years old and had to be put down. P.C. Holman was left heartbroken. He published his own tribute to his four-legged workmate with a book called My Dog Rex. It was renamed Dog vs. Crime when it was brought out in paperback. It was the first time a book had been devoted to the life of a police dog, and Rex's legend cemented in the public minds the idea of an Alsatian as the definitive police dog.
Of course, many of our listeners are fully aware of dogs' super abilities with their own wonderful guide dogs. You remember Dave and Graham's fascinating visit to Concord last week, and they now complete their visit to Bristol by finding out about John Cabot's ship that took him to discover Newfoundland.
Well, in Bristol, we're outside a pub, so what's significant? Whose picture is it on the pub sign, the Three Tuns?
It's American actor Nicolas Cage.
I'm in the middle of Bristol. I'm just walking through two waterfalls. There are water features here. And you've got to paddle along through water to get on dry land again. Oh, I'm in danger of getting bootfuls of water. Where are we now, Graham?
We are curious, like a science museum.
Wow, fantastic. This says, do you want to send a message to another you? The original of this golden disc was sent into space by NASA. It's full of greetings, sounds and songs, all designed for aliens. And we're sending messages into space too. Maybe one day they'll reach an alien. So, right, hello from me, from England on Earth. And I'd like to send you friendly greetings wherever you live. Thank you very much. Okay, I hope to hear from you someday. Well, I've just been to a big, shiny dome building, the planetarium. I speak to the gentleman that's guided us through on the space exploration. Can he tell us a little bit about the shows you put on, please?
Okay, so the show that we have just had is called Space Explorers, and its demographic is for those under the age of six. So you're thinking old babies, toddlers, that sort of thing. It's wonderful, it's colourful, and it gets the kids involved, and it teaches them about space and the solar system. But that's not all we offer here at the We the Curious Planetarium, because it's the only 3D planetarium in the UK that's open to the public. What this means is that we also have some shows that require you to don some very fashionable, futuristic-looking 3D glasses, which will enable you to see the cosmos in 3D, immersing you in it all. But of course, if you are blind or partially sighted, like myself, then the 3D might not be as effective for you. However, that's not a problem, because the presenters are very good at describing things as we go along. And of course, you have music and sound effects that still guide you through the cosmos.
Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Well, we've just come out of the We Are Curious Science Museum, and there among the water features is a whole big, large ball with reflective surfaces. And in that ball, we watched the planetarium show. Well, we're speaking to you now
going across the docks in the ferry in the direction of the SS Great Britain, ship built by Isambard Kingdom Brunel. So, what have we here, Graham?
Armand Headquarters.
Yeah, and there's a colourful Shaun the Sheep in front of it. Because Aardman make Wallace and Gromit and Shaun the Sheep, mainly out of plasticine. Their animated films are fantastic. And there's a big rabbit in the window. I think it's from the film The Curse of the Weir Rabbit. And it says, hello there, you're peeking inside the Aardman headquarters. We've been making animations in Bristol since 1976. Creations include Wallace and Gromit and Creature Comforts. They came to life right here on Gas Ferry Road, which is still home to a busy working studio. Well, we're walking along the riverside at Bristol, and there's some lovely boats there, isn't there? Okay, what boats are out there?
There's a nice boat called Miss Condor. It's got a mini helicopter on top, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. And there's a boat or replica of that took John Cabot to discover Newfoundland. I'm speaking to you by a lovely old wooden boat called the Matthew. I'm speaking to the person, the man here. What's your name?
Dave.
Can you talk about the history of the Matthew, please?
Oh, this one is a replica of a ship of the 15th century that John Cabot sailed from Bristol to discover North America. And in the 1990s, the ship was built to replicate the journey that John Cabot did 500 years previously. So in 1997, on the same day, May the 2nd, as John Cabot left Bristol, this ship left Bristol, sailed across the Atlantic, and made landfall in St. John's on Newfoundland, which is where we believe John Cabot landed.
That is absolutely amazing. So it's basically a sailing ship. So it must have been a fantastic journey.
I believe so. I wasn't on it, but they had their moments, apparently. It was quite stormy at times. But
I'm sure it was.
No idea, of course, what it was like in the 15th century. Although it replicated the sailing and the method of getting there, they had a few more home comforts in the 20th century that they didn't have in the 15th, like a fridge and a freezer, and an engine for that matter. But as far as the sailing was concerned, they reproduced the conditions, even to the extent of going backwards if the wind was in the wrong direction.
Well, we're just about to get the station, to get the train back to Coventry. I've had a fantastic holiday, have you, Graham?
Yeah, it's been a great time, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks a lot. That's all from Bristol. Bye!
Bye!
And now, to end this week's programme, Margaret completes the reading of the poem On the Marshes.
Dawn. Sunrise and slow lifting light seeps across me, dove grey at the moment streaked with raspberry pink, a slight breeze already building, chasing a few rain-laden clouds left from last night's shower. Boats in the estuary are tugging at their moorings. I hear creaking amidst rope and rigging. Good day for fishing. The horizon far-reaching and distinct. The nets will be filled by evening with silver darlings. There goes the Marsh Harrier aspiring to the heavens. There's energy in the air. Such a contrast between its playful aerial tumbling on the thermals, then ferocity and violence as it slices the salt marsh, makes a killing. And now the breeze-blown wings of avocet and gull flit across my awning. The marsh is awake. The reeds are up and glimmering. The shutters have opened on the morning. The day has fully dawned and I am ready. Mid-morning. I am a marsh harrier, risen from the reeds to grace the sea-blue sky. I am a wide-winged, fan-tailed, bronze-tipped, gold-clawed, speckle-necked titan of the marshes. A plundering, abducting, persecuting raptor of the reeds. A totem of determination, a force of will, persistent. I like the big picture, operating alone, plotting my next step. I am unassailable, an acrobatic, jousting playboy, reveller, skylarker, a colossus of the air. Mid-afternoon. I am a reed and I grow in the marshes, close to the water, which is flat calm at the moment. The sun is sitting high this afternoon, and I've been watching a marsh harrier court the skies. It has a lazy flight, a few slow flaps of its fan-fingered wings, and then a long wavering glide as it focuses on its prey when it suddenly drops low over the reed grasses. From a distance it looks acorn brown. I wonder what it's like to fly an expanse of sky like that. I am anchored to the marshes, rooted in the water. I bend in a storm, buffeted, but remain fixed, steadfast. I'm visited by lots of birds. In the last hour, I've seen meadow pipits, warblers and wagtails tilt and dart and weave through the rushes. I can distinguish each species just by listening to their song. I sing too, in a way. In fact, I am a hollow music-making wind chamber, and along with the other reeds on the marsh, we form a kind of orchestra. Together we balance and harmonise, moving as one and sounding as one. Our music differs according to the strength of the wind. In a light breeze, such as we have today, we make the softest music, a susurration. But in strong wind, we rasp and rattle quite fiercely. According to Celtic mythology, reed grasses are associated with St. Brigid, goddess of poetry. I am thinking of myself as poetic, as a poet of the marsh. Dusk. Twilight. Slow falling light. Birds are gathering on the marsh to roost beneath a slow setting sun. Gulls sail in and then out again. I've lived up to my name today, diving beetle, predaceous. I've fed well. Haven't sensed any threat today when I've come up for air. Good. Glimpse the world above the surface. Saw a marsh harrier dropping fast and low over the rushes. An impressive manoeuvre. Didn't wait to see what it caught, though, despite my blackish green colour providing good camouflage. The biggest threat to me is loss of habitat, which is a constant worry. This marshland suits me well. It's tranquil here. I like the pulse of the sea in the distance, the incessant drag on the shingle, and the scent of gorse which drifts across from the dunes if there's a breath of wind. The fishing boats will be returning to the estuary now, being moored for the night. I like the rhythmic thud as their hulls slap the water when there's a riffle of a breeze, which there is this evening. Night. I am sea. Collector and protector of treasures. An immensity from which everything proceeds and to which everything returns. Tonight I exhale beneath a darkened sky. Downlit by a single lantern, uplit by the lighthouse beam, I sift shells, polish stones, rinse the sands, sweep the dunes, refresh, revive, renew.
And that poem brings to an end this week's Outlook. So till next week, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Hewin, and all the Outlook team.